Geekbeat.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration is the 10th one from Geoffrey of Monmouth's The History of the Kings of Britain. And today we'll be dealing with the death of Hengist. When Merlin had made these prophecies, and others too, he filled all those present with amazement by the equivocal meaning of his words. Vortigern, who was even more astonished than the others, himself spoke highly of the young man's wit and his oracular pronouncements, for that particular period in history had produced no one who was ready to speak his mind in this way in front of the king. Vortigern wanted particularly to learn what his own end would be, and he asked the young man to tell him what he knew about it. Merlin gave the following answer. "Run from the fiery vengeance of the sons of Constantine. That is, if you have the power to escape it. At this very moment, they are fitting out their ships. Even as I speak, they are leaving the coasts of Armorica and spreading their sails to cross the sea. They will make for the island of Britain, attack the Saxon people, and conquer the race which they detest. The first thing they will be to burn you alive, shut up inside your tower. You made a fatal mistake when you betrayed their father and invited the Saxons to your island. You summoned them as your protectors, but in effect, their coming ensured your own violent death. Two different ways of dying threaten you, and it is not easy to see which of the two you will avoid. On the one hand, the Saxons are ravaging your kingdom and will try to kill you. On the other hand, the two brothers Aurelius and Uther are landing, and they will do their utmost to take vengeance on you for their father's death. Look for some refuge if you can, for tomorrow they will steer for the shore at Totnes. The Saxons' faces will be smeared with red blood, and when Hengist is killed, Aurelius Ambrosius will be crowned king. He will restore peace to the people and build up the church again, but he himself will die of poison. His brother, Uther Pendragon, will succeed him, but his days too will be cut short by poison. Your own descendants will play a part in this dastardly act, but the boar of Cornwall will eat them all up." When the next day dawned, with no time lost, Aurelius Ambrosius came ashore. As soon as the news of his coming reached them, the Britons, who had been scattered with such great slaughter, gathered together again from all sides, reassured as they were, and made more optimistic than they had been before by the coming of their fellow countrymen. The clergy were convened. They anointed Aurelius as king, and did homage to him in the usual way. The Britons counselled an immediate attack on the Saxons, but the king persuaded them against it, for he wanted to hunt down Vortigern first. Aurelius Ambrosius had been so grieved by the betrayal of his father that he felt no other action of any sort could be contemplated until he avenged him. In order to carry out his design, he marched his army into Cambria and made for the castle of Genero, for it was there that Vortigern had fled in his search for a safe refuge. This castle, which belonged to Ergin country, was beside the river Wye, on a hill called Cloartius. As soon as he reached the place, Ambrosius, who could think of nothing but the betrayal of his father and brother, said to Eldol, the Duke of Gloucester, "See now, my lord Duke, if the fortifications and the walls of this place can protect Vortigern and stop me burying the point of my sword in his entrails. He has earned a violent death, and I imagine that you yourself must be fully aware of how much he has deserved it. Of all men, he is surely the most villainous. How much he deserves to die of unmentionable tortures. First of all, he betrayed my father Constantine, who had freed him and his country from the invading Picts. Then he betrayed my brother Constance, whom he had caused to be made king so that he, Vortigern, could destroy him. Finally, when he had himself seized the crown by using his own crafty wits, he imported pagans to mix with the local population so that he could destroy the men who remained loyal to me. By God's will, he has himself now fallen, unwarily, into the very snare which he prepared for my faithful adherents. For when the Saxons discovered how evil he was, they drove him out of the kingdom, a deed which ought to grieve no one. However, in my opinion, there is one aspect of all this which everyone must regret, that this evil man, through the heathen whom he invited over, has exiled the nobility, laid waste a fertile country, destroyed the holy churches, and virtually obliterated Christianity from one sea to the other. Act then like true men, my fellow countrymen, and take your first vengeance upon him, by whose agency all these things have come about. After that, we must turn our arms against the enemies who beset us, and free our homeland from their hungry maw. They lost no time, but moved into position with their siege machines, and did their utmost to break down the walls. When everything else had failed, they tried fire, and this, once it took hold, went on blazing until it burned up the tower and Vortigern with it. When news of this reached Hengist and his Saxons, he was greatly frightened, for he dreaded the courage of Aurelius. The man was so brave and hardy that while he was living in various places in Gaul, no one had dared to meet him in single combat. Whenever he had fought such a duel, he either dashed his opponent from his horse, or else broke his own spear into splinters. What is more, he was liberal in his gifts, regular in his attendance at divine services, modest in all his behaviour, and unwilling ever to tell a lie. He fought well on foot, and even better when mounted, and he was most skilled in commanding an army. While Aurelius was still in Armorican Britain, rumour, which never halts its daily round, had brought reports of his accomplishments into the island. As a result, the Saxons dreaded him, and they now retreated across the Humber. They fortified the towns and castles in those parts, for the region had always been a refuge towards which they could retreat. The nearness of Scotland afforded them protection, for that country had never missed an opportunity of making matters worse whenever the Britons were in distress. It was a land frightful to live in, more or less uninhabited, and it offered a safe lurking place to foreigners. Indeed, by its geographical position, it lay open to the Picts, the Scots, the Danes, the Norwegians, and anyone else who came ashore to ravage the island. Assured as they thus were of the sympathy of the country, the Saxons retreated in that direction, so that if need arose, they could take refuge there, just as if they were in their own stronghold. As soon as this was reported to Aurelius, his courage rose, for he now had every hope of victory. He assembled his fellow countrymen, and as quickly as he could, reinforced his army and marched northwards. As he passed through the different regions, he grieved to see how desolate they were, but most of all, to find the churches razed to the ground. He swore that he would restore them if only he were victorious. Hengist took courage once more when he learned of the approach of Aurelius. He assembled a hand-picked army and gave encouragement to every single soldier, exhorting them all to fight like men and not be afraid to join battle with Aurelius. Hengist alleged that Aurelius had few Armorican Britons with him, for their number hardly exceeded 10,000. What is more, he expressed the lowest possible opinion of the island Britons, seeing that he had defeated them so often in battle. He promised his own men victory, and personal safety too, in view of their greater number, for there were about 200,000 armed men present. Once he had emboldened all his men in this way, Hengist marched to meet Aurelius in a field called Maesbelli, through which the latter was about to pass. Hengist planned to make a sudden surprise attack and to fall upon the Britons when they were least expecting it. However, this move could not be kept hidden from Aurelius. He did not avoid passing through the field because of this, but hurried on all the more quickly. The moment he came in sight of the enemy, he drew up his troops, he ordered 3,000 men from among the Armoricans to take up position with their horses. Those Armoricans who were left, he disposed in line of battle, here and there, among the islanders. He stationed the Domitians on the hills, and the Venedotians in the encircling woods. His reason for this was to ensure that should the Saxons flee in either of those directions, men should be there to block their way. Meanwhile, Eldol, Duke of Gloucester, went to the king and said, "I would consider this one day a sufficient recompense for all the remaining days of my life, if only God would grant that I might fight hand to hand with Hengist, for one of us two would die as we attacked each other with our swords. I remember the occasion on which we met, ready as we were on our side to make peace. While an agreement was being sought, Hengist betrayed every man present and had a knife stuck into each one of them, except me alone, for I discovered a wooden pole and so escaped. On that day, there died 480 great leaders and men of high rank, all of whom had come there unarmed. In that moment of great peril, God placed a wooden pole in my hand. With it, I defended myself and so escaped." These were the things which Eldol said. Aurelius then exhorted his comrades to place all their hope in the Son of God, to attack their enemies boldly, and to fight as one man for their homeland. On his side, Hengist was marshalling his troops, and as he placed them in position, he gave them instructions for the battle. He walked round among the ranks to give his orders, so that he could inspire everyone with a concerted zeal for the fight. Finally, when on both sides the companies had been posted in position, the two lines of battle joined combat, matching each other's blows and shedding a great amount of blood. Britons on this side and Saxons on that died of the wounds which they had received. Aurelius urged on the Christians, and Hengist encouraged the pagans. As long as they continued with this battle, Eldol never once stopped his attempts to find an opportunity for fighting hand to hand with Hengist, but he was not successful, for when Hengist saw that his men were beaten, and that by God's grace the Britons were victorious, he fled immediately, making his way to the castle of Carconan, which is now called Cunningburg. Aurelius pursued him, and killed or forced into slavery every man whom he overtook on the way. When Hengist saw that Aurelius was following him, he decided not to occupy the castle. He once more drew up his people in their companies, arranged them so that they were ready to join battle again, for he knew well that the castle could never withstand Aurelius, and that the only defence left to him lay in sword and spear. When Aurelius finally caught up with Hengist, he stationed his own soldiers in their companies and attacked with the utmost ferocity. However, the Saxons resisted as one man, and on both sides troops were wounded mortally. Wherever one looked, there was blood flowing, and the screams of the dying aroused to fury those who were still alive. The Saxons would have won in the end, if a cavalry detachment of Armorican Britons had not come on the scene. Aurelius had posted this squadron in exactly the same way as he had done in the first battle. When the cavalry arrived, the Saxons gave ground before it, and once they had moved from their positions, they were not able to reform. At this, the Britons attacked even more fiercely, rushing at the enemy as one man. All the time Aurelius was issuing orders to his own men, wounding such of the enemy as came his way, pursuing those who had turned in flight, and so bringing comfort to his own army. In the same way, Eldol rushed hither and thither, dealing deadly wounds to those who stood up to him, but whatever else occupied him, his heart was still set on the possibility of fighting hand to hand with Hengist. As the various companies of troops moved forward in this direction and that, by chance Eldol and Hengist were brought together, with no advantage to either of them, and they began to rain blows on each other. What men they were, and how much more warlike than the others. As each in turn slashed at the other with his sword, the sparks flew from his blows, as if he were at once a source of thunderclaps and of lightning flashes. For a long time, it was not clear on which side lay the greater strength. At one moment, Eldol pressed forward and Hengist yielded, and then Eldol drew back and Hengist advanced. As they fought on in this way, Gulwar, Duke of Cornwall, moved up towards them with the squadron which he commanded, harassing the enemy's companies as he came. When he set eyes on Gulwar, Eldol gained a new assurance. He seized hold of Hengist by the nasal of his metal helmet, and by exerting all his strength, dragged him in among his own men. A great flood tide of joy boiled up within him, and he shouted at the top of his voice, "God has granted my prayer. Now, men, down with what is left of the Ambrones. Victory is in your hand. Now that Hengist is beaten, you have beaten them all." While these things were happening, the Britons redoubled their attacks on the pagans, charging them again and again, and as they retreated, attacking them once more with ever-increasing courage. They gave them no respite, until finally victory was won. The pagans turned in flight, each man for himself. Some fled to the towns, some to the thickly wooded mountains, and others again to their own ships. Hengist's son Octa retreated to York with the biggest band, and his kinsman Eosa garrisoned that town with a great force of armed men. Once Aurelius had won the victory in this way, he seized the town of Conan, which I have already mentioned earlier on, and there he halted for 3 days. During this time, he ordered the dead to be buried, the wounded to receive medical attention, the weary to take rest, and all of them to refresh themselves with such consolations as they could find. Next, he called his leaders together and ordered them to decide what should be done with Hengist. Among those present was Eldadus, Bishop of Gloucester, the brother of Eldol, and a man of the greatest wisdom and piety. When Eldadus saw Hengist standing before the king, he ordered the others to be silent and spoke as follows. "Even if you were all doing your level best to have this man set free, I would hack him in pieces myself. In this, I would be following the prophet Samuel, who, when he held in his power Agag, king of Amalek, hewed him in pieces, saying, 'As thy sword hath made women childless, so shall thy mother be childless among women.' Do therefore the same with this man, who is clearly a second Agag." Thereupon Eldol took his sword, led Hengist outside the city, and packed him off to hell by cutting off his head. Aurelius, who was moderate in all that he did, ordered Hengist to be buried and a barrow of earth to be raised over his body, that being the pagan custom. Then Aurelius led his army to York in order to besiege Octa, the son of Hengist. When Aurelius started investing the city, Octa had doubts as to whether or not he should resist and defend it against such a huge army. He took the advice of his men and then emerged with the more noble of those who were with him, carrying a chain in his hand and having coarse gravel on his head. He presented himself before the king and made the following speech. "My own gods are vanquished. I do not doubt for a moment that it is your God who reigns supreme, for he has compelled so many noblemen to appear before you in this manner. Accept, then, both our persons and this length of chain. If you are not prepared to grant us mercy, then have us bound, for, of our own free will, we are ready for whatever punishment you propose to inflict." Aurelius was filled with compassion, and he ordered a decision to be made on what should be done with the Saxons. When the others had expressed conflicting opinions, Bishop Eldadus rose to his feet again and gave his own advice in the following words. "The Gibeonites came of their own free will to seek mercy of the children of Israel, and they received that mercy. Shall we Christians be harder than the Israelites and refuse mercy to these men? It is mercy they are asking for. Let them have mercy, I say. The island of Britain is big enough, and in many parts there are no inhabitants at all. Let them occupy those places, then, and be our subjects for all time." The king, agreed to what Eldadus advised, and took pity on the Saxons. Following Octa's example, Eosa too came in, and the others who had fled with him, and they received pardon. Aurelius granted them the region near Scotland, and signed a treaty with them. With his enemies beaten, Aurelius summoned to York his leading men and the princes of his realm, and ordered them to restore the churches which the Saxon people had destroyed. He himself began to rebuild the metropolitan cathedral of that city and the other episcopal churches in the sea. When 15 days had passed, and he had put the various craftsmen to work in the places concerned, he set off for the town of London, which the fury of the enemy had certainly not spared. Grieved as he was by the destruction of the town, he collected together from every quarter such citizens as were left alive, and began the task of rebuilding it. It was from that city that he ruled his kingdom, bringing new life to laws which had been allowed to fall into disuse, and restoring to their rightful heirs the scattered possessions of long-dead folk. Any estates which, in this major disaster, had no one left alive to inherit them, were shared among those who had fought at his side. The entire energy of Aurelius was devoted to restoring the realm, rebuilding the churches, renewing peace and the rule of law, and administering justice. Next, he went to Winchester to restore that town, as he had restored others like it. As soon as he had repaired everything that needed such attention, if the town was to be restored at all, he took the advice of Bishop Eldadus and visited the monastery near Carcharadoc, which is now called Salisbury. It was there that were buried the leaders and princes whom the infamous Hengist had betrayed. A monastery of 300 brethren stood there, on Mount Ambrius, for it was Ambrius, so they say, who had founded the monastery years before. As Aurelius inspected the place in which the dead lay, he was moved to compassion and burst into tears. In the end, he turned his mind to other considerations, asking himself what he could do to ensure that the spot should be remembered, for it was his opinion that the greensward, covering so many noble men who had died for their fatherland, was certainly worthy of some memorial. Aurelius collected carpenters and stonemasons together from every region and ordered them to use their skill to contrive some novel building which would stand forever in memory of such distinguished men. The whole band racked their brains and then confessed themselves beaten. Then Tremorinus, Archbishop of the City of the Legions, went to the king and said, "If there is anyone anywhere who has the ability to execute your plan, then Merlin, the prophet of Vortigern, is the man to do it. In my opinion, there is no one else in your kingdom who has greater skill, either in the foretelling of the future or in mechanical contrivances. Order Merlin to come and use his ability so that the monument for which you are asking can be put up." Aurelius asked many questions about Merlin. Then he sent a number of messengers through the various regions of the country to find him and fetch him. They travelled through the provinces and finally located Merlin in the territory of the Gavissi, at the Galabese Springs, where he often went. They explained to him what they wanted of him and then conducted him to the king. The king received Merlin gaily and ordered him to prophesy the future, for he wanted to hear some marvels from him. "Mysteries of that sort cannot be revealed," answered Merlin, "except where there is the most urgent need for them. If I were to utter them as an entertainment, or where there was no need at all, then the spirit which controls me would forsake me in the moment of need." He gave the same refusal to everyone present. The king had no wish to press him about the future, but he spoke to him about the monument which he was planning. "If you want to grace the burial place of these men with some lasting monument," replied Merlin, "send for the giant's ring, which is on Mount Killaruse in Ireland. In that place there is a stone construction which no man of this period could ever erect unless he combined great skill and artistry. The stones are enormous, and there is no one alive strong enough to move them. if they are placed in position around this site in the way in which they are erected over there, they will stand forever. At these words of Merlin's, Aurelius burst out laughing. How can such large stones be moved from so far distant a country? He asked. It is hardly as if Britain itself is lacking in stones big enough for the job. Try not to laugh in a foolish way, Your Majesty, answered Merlin. What I am suggesting has nothing ludicrous about it. These stones are connected with certain secret religious rites, and they have various properties which are medicinally important. Many years ago, the giants transported them from the remotest confines of Africa and set them up in Ireland at a time when they inhabited that country. Their plan was that, whenever they felt ill, baths should be prepared at the foot of the stones, for they used to pour water over them and to run this water into baths in which their sick were cured. What is more, they mixed the water with herbal concoctions and so healed their wounds. There is not a single stone among them which hasn't some medicinal virtue. When the Britons heard all this, they made up their minds to send for the stones and to make war on the people of Ireland if they tried to hold them back. In the end, the king's brother, Uther Pendragon, and 15,000 men were chosen to carry out the task. Merlin, too, was co-opted so that all the problems which had to be met could have the benefit of his knowledge and advice. They made ready their ships, and they put to sea. The winds were favourable, and they arrived in Ireland. At that time, there reigned in Ireland a young man of remarkable valour called Gillemanius. As soon as he heard that the Britons had landed in the country, he collected a huge army together and hurried to meet them. When he learned the reason of their coming, Gillemanius laughed out loud at those standing around him. I am not surprised that a race of cowards has been able to devastate the island of the Britons, said he, for the Britons are dolts and fools. Who ever heard of such folly? Surely the stones of Ireland aren't so much better than those of Britain that our realm has to be invaded for their sake. Arm yourselves, men, and defend your fatherland, for as long as life remains in my body, they shall not steal from us the minutest fragment of the ring. When he saw that the Irish were spoiling for a fight, Uther hurriedly drew up his own line of battle and charged at them. The Britons were successful almost immediately. The Irish were either mangled or killed outright, and Gillemanius was forced to flee. Having won the day, the Britons made their way to Mount Killerus. When they came to the stone structure, they were filled with joy and wonder. Merlin came up to them as they stood round in a group. Try your strength, young men, said he, and see whether skill can do more than brute strength, or strength more than skill, when it comes to dismantling these stones. At his bidding, they all set to with every conceivable kind of mechanism, and strove their hardest to take the ring down. They rigged up hawsers and ropes, and they propped up scaling ladders, each preparing what he thought most useful, but none of these things advanced them an inch. When he saw what a mess they were making of it, Merlin burst out laughing. He placed in position all the gear which he considered necessary and dismantled the stones more easily than you could ever believe. Once he had pulled them down, he had them carried to the ships and stored on board, and they all set sail once more for Britain with joy in their hearts. The winds were fair. They came to the shore and then set off with the stones for the spot where the heroes had been buried. The moment that this was reported to him, Aurelius dispatched messengers to all the different regions of Britain, ordering the clergy and the people to assemble, and, as they gathered, to converge on Mount Ambrius, where they were, with due ceremony and rejoicing, to rededicate the burial place which I have described. At the summons from Aurelius, the bishops and abbots duly assembled with men from every rank and file under the king's command. All came together on the appointed day. Aurelius placed the crown on his head and celebrated the Feast of Whitsun in right royal fashion, devoting the next 3 days to one long festival. As part of this, he bestowed lands on those who had no holdings of their own, thus rewarding them for the efforts they had made to serve him. the two metropolitan sees of York and the city of the legions were without incumbents. With the general consent of his people, whom he wished to consult in this matter, Aurelius gave York to Samson, a most distinguished man who was famous for his great piety. The city of the legions he bestowed upon Dubricius, whom divine providence had already singled out as one suitable for promotion there. Once he had settled these matters, and others of a similar nature, Aurelius ordered Merlin to erect around the burial place the stones which he had brought from Ireland. Merlin obeyed the king's orders and put the stones up in a circle around the sepulchre in exactly the same way as they had been arranged on Mount Killerus in Ireland, thus proving that his artistry was worth more than any brute strength.